Well, let me begin with a recent article by New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis, in which he defends the media against the charge that they've become too independent and too powerful for the public good. He writes that the press is protected by the First Amendment, not for its own sake, but to enable a free political system to operate. In the end, the concern is not for the reporter or the editor, but for the citizen critic of government. What's at stake when we speak of freedom of press, he says, is the freedom to perform a function on the behalf of the polity. Lewis goes on to cite Supreme Court justices and other judges who observe, these are all quotes, that no individual can obtain for himself the information needed for the intelligent discharge of his political responsibilities. By enabling the public to assert meaningful control over the political process, the press performs a crucial function in affecting the societal purpose of the First Amendment. Therefore, quotes, a cantankerous press, an obstinate press, a ubiquitous press must be suffered by those in authority in order to preserve the even greater values of freedom of expression and the right of the people to know. Now, I do not think that we should accept the view that freedom of expression has to be defended in instrumental terms by virtue of its contribution to some higher good, rather it's a value in itself. But that apart, these ringing declarations do express valid aspirations, and they surely express the general self-image of the American media. Now the question is, what's the relation between that self-image and the facts? The facts seem to me to show something rather different. Namely, in contrast to the conception of the media as cantankerous, obstinate and ubiquitous in their search for truth and their independence of authority, the actual evidence appears to show with quite considerable clarity that the media do serve a societal purpose, but not that of enabling the public to assert meaningful control over the political process by providing them with the information that's needed for the intelligent discharge of political responsibilities, as was just quoted. On the contrary, the actual societal purpose, which the media serve very effectively, is to inculcate and defend the economic, social, and political agenda of privileged groups that dominate the domestic society and the state. The media serve this societal purpose in many ways, through selection of topics, distribution of concerns, framing of issues, filtering of information, emphasis, and tone. I think we should agree with Chief Justice Hughes, whom Lewis also cites, on the primary need of a vigilant and courageous press if democratic processes are to function in a meaningful way. But the evidence shows clearly enough that this need is not met or even weakly approximated in actual practice. Now, the reasons for the overwhelming tendencies which I'm describing, they are overwhelming tendencies. You can find a deviation here and there. But the reasons for the overwhelming tendencies in fulfillment of this actual societal purpose, these reasons are not particularly obscure on essentially guided free market assumptions that are not at all controversial. Simply think about what the private media are. In essence, the private media are major corporations that have a market, namely other businesses called advertisers, and they sell a product, namely readers and audiences, to these other businesses. From an institutional point of view, that's what the corporate media are. Furthermore, the national media, are the ones that are most influential in setting the general political agenda and so on, they typically target and they serve elite opinion, groups which on the one hand provide an optimal profile, as it's called, for advertising purposes, and therefore maximize revenue, and on the other hand, play a role in decision-making and in the private and the public spheres. The national media would be failing to meet their elite audience's needs if they did not present a tolerably realistic portrayal of the world, but their societal purpose also requires that the media's interpretation of the world reflect the interests and concerns of the sellers, the buyers, and the institutions dominated by these groups, in particular the state, whatever segment of the business classes happens to be in control of the state at a particular moment. So it's not surprising that this societal purpose should be fulfilled with such dramatic success. In these terms, we can also understand another pervasive phenomenon, namely the way in which media personnel adapt to the institutional demands. Conformity to the needs and interests of privileged sectors is simply essential to success. In the media, as in other major institutions, those who do not display the requisite values and perspectives will be regarded as irresponsible, ideological, or otherwise aberrant, and they'll fall by the wayside. Now, there'll be a small number of exceptions, but the pattern is pervasive and expected. Those who adapt, and perhaps quite honestly so, those who adapt will then be able, they'll be perfectly free to express themselves with essentially no managerial control, and they'll be able to assert quite accurately that they perceive no pressures to conform. The media are indeed free for those who adopt the principles required for their societal purpose. Now, there may be some who are simply corrupt, who serve as errand boys for the state and other authority. The description of New York Times correspondent Stephen Kinzer by Edgar Chamorro, who was selected by the CIA as a press spokesman for the Contras. But that's not the norm. The media form part of a larger intellectual community where institutional factors induce similar effects, and they do so in the same manner through the normal workings of power. One immediate prediction from these rather natural assumptions is that nothing that I'm now saying could be understood within the general culture. The reason is that to fulfill their societal purpose, responsible intellectuals must conceal from themselves and from others what their societal function is. Otherwise, that function cannot be fulfilled. So it follows that one could demonstrate quite conclusively, with a huge weight of evidence dealing with every imaginable topic, that mass media do serve the societal purpose of safeguarding power and privilege, but these results could not be understood. In fact, the words could barely be heard. This prediction, too, is very well confirmed. There's by now a huge mass of evidence in print demonstrating that the media serve their actual societal purpose. The effect of all of that is zero, and I think we could be certain that the evidence that the effect would remain zero, even if the standards of proof reached those of physics or even surpassed them. There's a good institutional reason for that. Now, the media, in fact, delight in the right-wing jingoist critique that they go too far in their adversarial stance. That provides the occasion for solemn declarations on the need for a cantankerous and obstinate press in a functioning democracy. And furthermore, the criticisms are usually so totally ludicrous that they can be easily refuted. But an accurate description of the media as subservient and conformist is literally unintelligible, and the evidence simply cannot be considered, which makes perfect sense. Again, it's completely explicable on normal grounds of simple institutional analysis. Just to give one example, there's a recent book called Reporters Under Fire, edited by Landrum Balling, which is concerned with U.S. media coverage of the United States and of the Middle East and Central America. Now, it contains a critique of the media as anti-Israel, as unfair to the United States in its noble endeavors. It also contains a refutation of that critique, but barely a word suggesting that a rather different interpretation might be conceivable, and that's very typical and also entirely natural. That's exactly what any reasonable person should expect, looking at the way the society is constructed and it works. Well, let me give one concrete example of how these things work out. I've done a number of analytic studies of the media in Central America. I'll keep to that topic. You could pick any other one, but let's keep to Central America. And these are very revealing. So let me just mention one, come back to another later. This one deals with the New York Times and the Washington Post, the two national media, at a crucial moment of debate over Central America, namely the first 3 months of 1986, when everything was peaking towards the Contra vote and the amount of attention, in fact, peaked. I reviewed all the opinion columns, that means their own columnists, invited op-eds, and so on. And the point was to determine the range of expressible opinion. The point was not to evaluate particular contributions. Anybody can say what they like, but the question is, what's the range of opinion that's expressible? Now, there's a prediction that comes out that will immediately come to mind. Prediction would be that the range of expressible opinion will conform closely or exactly to the spectrum of tactical disagreement among elite groups, and that, in fact, is precisely verified. Let's first look at the elite groups. There is a tactical disagreement about the best way to, as they put it, contain Nicaragua, or restore Nicaragua to the Central American mode, or restore regional standards. I'm now quoting the liberal Washington Post that the dovish in. In fact, that by early 1986, when I was doing this, there was a growing concern that the Contra option is not cost-effective and is probably no longer necessary because we essentially achieved the goal of restoring Nicaragua to the Central American mode of misery and suffering. And that had included about 80% of leadership groups by early 1986. So what you'd predict is that in the media there would be debate over Contra aid, and indeed there was. You look at these 85 columns, there's plenty of debate over Contra aid. Shall we use the violent means to restore them to the Central American mode, or should we use some other means? So let's take the extreme dovish end. At the extreme dovish end, you have, for example, Tom Wicker, who says as follows, March 14th, the Contras have signally failed to weaken the Sandinistas' grip on power or to gain a foothold in Nicaragua. The policy is a clear failure. Congress should therefore reject the failed policy and favor a negotiated regional arrangement that would be enforced by Nicaragua's neighbors, not the United States. That's the dovish end. Now, notice a few points. One of them is that on the assumptions that are expressed at the dovish end, as here, if the policy of violence and terror were to succeed, then it would apparently be okay. At least there's no indication to the contrary. Second point, notice that there's no need, according from this point of view, the dovish point of view, to enforce any arrangement on Guatemala and El Salvador, where the military are happily slaughtering their civilian populations, or on Honduras, where hundreds of thousands of peasants at that time and still were starving to death while the country exports food. Apparently that's okay. In fact, that is the Central American mode, so we don't have to say anything about it. Notice that there's no need, it seems, to enforce any arrangement on the United States, despite a certain amount of evidence that the U.S. government record on adherence to international law and to treaties may have an occasional flaw to it. Well, that's the dovish end in the media. What about the corresponding debate in Congress? Again, we find pretty much the same spectrum. So just sampling the dovish end again, since we're in California, take the liberal dove, Alan Cranston. He explained in Senate testimony at exactly that time that Reagan's resort to violence had proven inadequate. So therefore, I'm quoting him now, we should isolate the reprehensible government of the Marxists in Managua and leave it to fester in its own juices. In contrast, Pol Pot-style terror in El Salvador and Guatemala, which is backed or directly organized by the United States, that merits no such recommendations. We don't have to let them fester in their own juices. In fact, we should continue to support them.